Sharon B. from Los Angeles, California, who's going to share her experience, strength, and hope with us tonight.
My name is Sharon Barker. I'm an alcoholic. You said we can't touch that. I wanted to. Tell me I can't do something and I want to.
Go ahead.
Okay. There. And now I feel better. Okay. Thank you for having me up here. Thank you, Mark, and everybody else. Casey and I came up a couple of days, well, it seems like days ago. It was yesterday morning, actually, and we had a little vacation, went to the city and just had some fun and found some nice Italian places to eat and drank cappuccinos and walked around the city and the parts of North Beach where he used to live years ago and all the famous places. You know, we all have these famous places in our past and there's a story with each one of them, and it was a lot of fun and I like it up here. It's got a good feeling to it, this part of the world, and it's fun to be with you. I know that there's maybe a misconception about us Los Angelinians, is that the right way to say it? But really, we're good people. We have great sobriety down there. If you ever get a chance to come to any of our meetings, please do. Please call central office and come, because there's a lot of enthusiasm going on. And that's one of the reasons I think I'm still living where I was living. I mean, 16 years ago, I was on my way to Hawaii, and I haven't made it yet. I got sober in Southern California, and that's where I still am. And it's been fun to be able to celebrate Casey's 9th birthday up here, too, and it's really been nice. I have 16 years and 3 months and 10 days of sobriety, and it's a day at a time. It's a day at a time. Yeah. It's today. I mean, what I do, well, my sobriety is definitely contingent upon what I do today, and I try to be of service in my life, in Alcoholics Anonymous, in my community. I try to be of service where I work, be of service with the other mothers that I know, and actually even be of service in the community that I'm, the Catholic community that I practice sometimes in. You know, I'm not real good about it, but I'm a different person than I was 16 years and 3 months ago. I am not the same person. I don't look the same. I am physically not the same. I am emotionally sometimes still the same, but spiritually I am entirely a different human being. And that's one of the gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's one of the miracles that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous, that you can have a spiritual awakening here. It says so in step 12. That as a result of working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, it can happen to you. And that's a given. And that's a beautiful set of tools that you get to have walking into this program, is those steps. And, you know, they can hand them to you, and they handed them to me, but I had to work them. Nobody could work them for me. And the people in Alcoholics Anonymous showed me how to do that. By their actions and by their kindness and sometimes by their meanness, you know. I don't know about you, but I had an awful mean sponsor when I was new, and she made me angry a lot, and it worked. You know, she was smart, you know, because the anger made me overcome my fear, and I did a lot more because I wanted to call her up and tell her she was wrong a lot of the time. You know, in 16 years, I haven't had to do that. When I turn my judgment over to somebody else's, when I am in emotional crisis. And so if you're new, and there are a lot of new people here, I hope you find a sponsor, especially one that is louder than your own head. It definitely works. And I hope you walk out of this room tonight with a sponsor if you need one. I grew up in Iowa, and that was my very first resentment in my life. From that point on, it was, I never fit in. I mean, I knew where I was, where I grew up, I didn't fit in. And I didn't fit into that family, and I didn't fit in anywhere in my life. And I had the thoughts of a loner. I always had friends because I was good at that. I was real good at having friends and being social and, and having the outsides look okay. I was really good at that from a very early age on. But my insides were always lonely and morbid and strange thoughts and strange quirks. And I just had a lot of strangeness about me. And I shared them with one of my best friends once growing up. And she didn't talk to me for 2 years. She didn't want to play with me. So I learned not to share those type of things with anybody. And I had drinks growing up at the Czechoslovakian wedding dances, you know, and that's, I mean, they partied, they got married, they had a dinner, and then they danced all night, and there was always a lot of booze around. That's where I learned to dance, and that's where I learned to sip on those screwdrivers. But I remember getting drunk the summer of my 14th birthday. I was 13 years old. It must have been July. It was in the middle of the summer, and we were out on those country roads, and it was a hot night, and we were sitting on the cars looking at the stars, and I was looking for UFOs because I was always looking for the mothership. You know, I just always was. And they had some Canadian Club and some Schlitz beer, and I took a swig off of each one of those, and I took another swig off of each one of those, and it went down nice and smooth, and I remember feeling full to my toes. I remember just feeling warm to my toes. And when I slid off the top of that 57 Chevy, it just seemed like puberty hit me like that, you know? My knock knees straightened out, my little bumps stood up, and I stood up, and, you know, I held that cigarette like Marilyn Monroe and had that certain cock in the hips that weren't there yet, but, you know, it just, something happened to me that night, something magical. Alcohol transformed me. Alcohol didn't do that for everybody else that night on that country road, but I didn't know that. I just thought this was the best thing that ever happened to me because I drove the car that night, I told jokes that night, I danced that night, and I blacked out that night. I woke up sick and hungover, but I remembered that instant. That instant where it was transformed for me, and alcohol did that for me, and I put that together. And growing up where I grew up, it was hard to get, but I managed to get drunk, and I managed to get through high school getting drunk as much as I could. I remember going out at halftime. I was a cheerleader, you know, and I would go out at halftime and smoke as many cigarettes and drink as much as I could and then come back in, you know, and stand on that floor and try to cheerlead. And I just got through okay. I got stopped by the police a couple of times. I would cry or talk my way out of it. I didn't seem to get into any trouble that was apparent. And as I went off to college, it was a license to just party. I was in college, and there was nobody watching over me, and it was the late 60s. And there was a lot of drugs available, and I'm the type of alcoholic that says more. I don't say, what is it? What will it do to me? I just say more, you know. And so I combined my alcohol with my drugs for the next so many years. And I had a transformation in college, too. I had my heart broken. I had some things happen to me that kind of made me didn't want to go that nice little square life. I didn't want to have a two-car garage, 2.5 kids, and a pig farm. I didn't want to do it. And I started to kind of deviate from the norm. I started to judge my parents' life and judge those people. And when I went off to the 1968 Democratic National Convention to campaign for the peace candidate with my sorority sisters, you know, and we were wearing nice sweaters and skirts and patent leather shoes and maybe even gloves and the hats, and we were standing there passing buttons out and with Paul McCartney, you know, Paul Newman. I wish it would have been Paul McCartney. I might not have been here tonight, but... Because Paul Newman was there, and there were some other people, and we were inside, and we were supposedly, you know, the young society girls coming up. And by the end of that convention, I had seen what was going on, and they looked like they were having more fun out there. You know, it was more exciting, and there was some bloodletting going on, you know, and I just, I don't know, I just got turned around, and I ended up following Dick Gregory to Mayor Daley's house, you know, smoking a joint, and the bell bottoms were on, and the patent leather shoes were in the closet and never to come out again, you know, and the peace sign was in one hand, and the finger was in the other, and I was ready, you know, I was ready for anything, and I thought this was a much more exciting life, was this anger and this protesting, and all of this started to come out of me, and it was a good vehicle to let it happen. And I went off back to college, and I started to, of course, I dropped out, and I started taking fine arts and art classes, and the weirdness that went on with that, and I fit right into all of that real well. And but something happened with my relationship with my parents about this time too. See, my father's paying for this schooling, And he came down to see me after my suicide attempt. You know, that should have given me a clue something wasn't right. And sent me to a psychiatrist and brought the family priest to talk to me. And the priest and I got very, very roaring drunk that night, I remember. And it was one of those evenings where I could just, you know, my father was sitting across the table just shaking his head. And me and the priest were, you know, politics talking. And I took him to the union, introduced him to all my radical friends and, you know, my Black Panther friends and all of those people. And they were hugging and, you know, it was quite a scene, this Roman Catholic priest and these radical students and, you know, all making this big pact that evening. And my father was just shaking his head. And I didn't get better, and my dad and my father's and my relationship didn't get better, and I started to get very, very sick, and I ended up in New York City because my dad packed my bags, basically said, you know, if you know, go to work or pay for your own college, and you know, our relationship is pretty over here, and because I was starting to bring my anger home, and I was beginning to point the finger, and I was beginning to judge, and I was beginning to make it your fault. And I continued for the next so many years of my drinking to make it your fault that I was beginning to live the life I was living. You know, I was beginning to feel the way I felt. And I ended up in New York and tried to pull it together and work for an ad agency. But I was taking a lot of amphetamines, and I was drinking two-hour lunches because they did. They drank a lot at lunch. And then we would drink after work, and then I would drink in the bar and have the bumps on my head read by my standing appointment with my phrenologist, you know. And then I would do the tarot cards and the I Ching and walk Central Park and maybe end up at the Golden Rail and come back home down Broadway and take some more amphetamines and look for truth. And then, you know, on top of that summer, I took a ton of LSD, and I found truth a number of times, you know. But you forget where you leave it, you know, and you can't quite recreate the situation, and nobody wrote it down, and it's like, it was gone, you know. I remember finding out on the Rolling Stone Satanic Majesty's Request album, it was there, truth was there, and I would pick that album up the next day, and I couldn't find that cut, you know, and it was so frustrating. I had to have some truth in I knew I was, there was a missing piece. There was a big missing piece, and it was, and I guess what I knew, it was something that was soul, you know, in my soul. It was something that was really missing in my soul. And you don't really tell somebody that I'm not a full soul. I don't have a full spirit, you know. And because they look at you funny, and that doesn't get you a drink in the bar, you know. That just doesn't do it. And so I kind of kept sucking it together, and I finally had this nervous breakdown and ended up calling my father and begging him to let me go back to college because I was tired. I couldn't do it out there. And I went back to college, and I went back to those art classes, and that's when something happened to me that I didn't plan on happening to me. It was that my artistic ability now was not on the natch anymore. It was only chemically induced. I couldn't sit down and create and do what I bring happiness to a page anymore, you know, and bring something out or put down what I could see and feel. It had to be chemically induced, and that depressed me. And my father came to visit me because I think I was a little thin, and my mother said, take her some groceries, you know. And he brought me down some groceries, and as he came into the house, there was a pound of grass I was cleaning on the table instead of being in class that day. So my bags were packed again for me, and my father and I kind of really split ways, and I ended up in Colorado because I had just read a Western novel. It sounded like a good idea. I'm an impulsive person, and that's where I went. And I was working at near Aspen, and it was an equestrian type of restaurant, and that's as close as I got to being a cowboy, and I had been behaving myself pretty well and not causing too much of a scene in this small town. And in that restaurant one day walked this guy who was Bob Dylan, and he was my hero. You know, he was one of my heroes. And this man stood at the counter and ordered a chocolate milkshake to go, and my head is racing, and I told you I'm really good on snap decisions, so I made two chocolate milkshakes to go and put my waitress apron down and walked out the door and with this guy and said, where are we going, Bob? And got in the car, and we came to California. And that was, you know, my life changed again, and it was on another instant decision. I was real good at that. You know, I was real good at making snap decisions, and all of this in my life has kind of come together for me now with the type of work I do now. I have to make a lot of quick decisions, so, you know, but now it's based on a little bit of experience and sobriety. But I don't pick up and pack my bags at every whim or every novel or every book I read. But I ended up in Colorado or California, and it was at Huntington Beach. I stayed at a commune, and I stayed for 4 months. I left with $2 and a dog, and I thought, you know, I made a profit. You know, it was great. And they taught me how to panhandle, and I wasn't very good at it because I had no self-esteem. And, you know, you can't really stand on a corner for 4 hours and ask everybody who goes by that, you know, you really don't want to give me any money, and they're not going to give you any money. And so I didn't make a lot of money, but it was okay, and I left. They gave me $4, and I had this dog, and I went back to Colorado, and I ended up at this little cabin that I lived at, and somebody else was living there, wearing my things, cooking with my utensils, and basically living, you know, with my things. And I walked in that place and took out some photographs that were in a box and said that, you know, excuse me, these are mine. I used to live here, and I left. And when I walked away from that cabin and the door slammed, I remember thinking I should go back and get my things back. You know, they're wearing my clothing. They're sleeping in my sheets. They're cooking with my, you know, these are my things on the walls. And I couldn't even do it. I could not turn around and go back and ask for my own things back. And I thought that there was something really wrong with me, that I didn't even have enough worth as a human to say, that's mine, I want it back. And I was 21 years old and dying of alcoholism. I ended up with my mother and father living upstairs. My father and I didn't speak. My mother said that she didn't want any trouble in the house, and please don't take any drugs if I was going to live there. See, they thought that was the problem, but it was okay to drink. I had a lot of toxicity going on in my body, and they took me to the family doctor, and they gave me Valium for my nerves. What was happening was I had a non-functional gallbladder, pancreatitis, and I was very toxic and very, very sick at 21 years old, and nobody knew alcoholism. To me, there was a town drunk, you know, and he used to come by and borrow a bottle from my dad, because my dad had his own business, so he'd have his own booze, and he didn't drink much, but he just used it for business. And so I would give the town drunk a bottle and tell my dad that so-and-so came by and borrowed two bottles, you know, because I always got one. So I liked that town drunk, you know. To me, that's all I knew. I didn't know alcoholic. I didn't know alcoholism. I didn't know alcoholism interfering with my life. I sat at the taverns and in that small town that winter and judged everybody, you know, who was in there every night, and I'm in there every night. And basically what happened was my life took a very bad turn. I got very depressed. I got very lonely. My dog was killed that winter. The dog that had been hitchhiking with me all the way back from California, she was frozen in the trunk of my car for months because I couldn't bury her, and I would get drunk and talk to my dead dog, and that was really a very lonely point in my life. And my mother was very glad when it thawed and we could bury that dog. And they all knew I was strange, and I, you know, Thanksgiving is just come and gone. And I remember that Thanksgiving that they didn't even set a place for me at the big table. I had to sit with the children at my grandmother's house. They weren't quite sure what I was going to say, how I was going to act, or if my head was going to end up in the plate, you know. And I remember going outside of that house, and I remember laying in the corn stalks, which were, you know, short because they were there in the snow, and looking inside of this house with them in this nice warm house with the window, and everything looked glowing, and they were in there moving around, and I thought, I don't belong to them. You know, I'm lying out there in the snow, face down in these corn stalks, probably smoking a joint, looking at all of them in there, and you know, I was really on the outside looking in of life. I really was. And that was a very low point in my life, and I met somebody who said they would take care of me, and I said, sure. And we ended up at an organic farm in northern Wisconsin, which was going to help me get well, and took away my cigarettes, it took away my alcohol, and gave me organic pot to smoke. And we went to work on this organic farm and smoked a lot of organic pot day and night, and had 50 head of organic sheep, an organic cat, dog, horse. You know, everybody around there was organic. We shopped at an organic co-op in Minneapolis. I mean, everything was just organic. And you know, we read organic. We read Mother Earth News, Yul Gibbons, Del Davis. You know, everything was organic. Even the poetry, everything was organic. And I just was sitting there one night in my rocking chair, and it was about this time of the year, because I remember I had stuffed, the turkey with organic marijuana stuffing. it turned out great. It was really, really pretty good. I don't know if anybody tasted anything, but It was right after Thanksgiving, and it was the second snowfall, and I was rocking in my rocking chair, you know, reading that Mother Earth news, and Phil was over in the corner playing his banjo that he'd never learned to play, and he had the phonograph on with the Pete Seeger record telling him how to play the banjo, and Pete Seeger sounded really a lot like Big Bird that night, and it seemed like, you know, he would miss another note, and he would start the record over, and the cat's flicking its tail, and I'm rocking in the chair, and the dog has got its tongue hanging out with a look like, God, do something, you know. And there's no TV, and there's no radio, you know. It's just I'm rocking, and I flew out of the chair, and I got in the car with a big sun painted on the hood, and I rolled into this general store town. One store, one general store. Had two cheap gallons of wine. I got them. Got in the car. I got home. I put the wine on the table before the snow got too heavy, and I was like, I mean, I just felt better that the wine was in the house. And I had a couple of glasses, and I felt better. And the cat was smiling, and the dog was happy, and the Rolling Stones were on. And this guy went to bed, and you know, I thought, God, I missed this. You know, I missed this because this pot wasn't just, it wasn't doing it. And what happened that night was I made a very important decision because he woke up and saw me having my cowboy boots on and my party going on, and he gave me that look. You know, and I know you've all seen that look, or, you know, and maybe you Al-Anons in here have given that look, but that look is there, you know, and but that look said to me, it didn't say to me, what is, you know, it didn't say to me, you know, I wish I could help you. It never said to me that, and that's what probably a lot of people I know, people wanted to help me, and they were confused, and they were hurt, and but I always read it as, you're not good enough. You're never going to be good enough. You're not going to live up to your potential. And, you're one big screw-up. And that's the way I always read those kind of looks. It was always in the negative, judgmental, poor-me victim way. And I made a decision that night, which was, you know what? Alcohol is more fun than you. And I vowed to myself not to get thirsty again, and I didn't. And I eventually drove people away, and I eventually had this half acre of marijuana to myself, organic marijuana, of course, that I was growing. And eventually winter was coming, and I had to get out of town, so I harvested it, and I put it in big hefty bags, and I had my big dope deal in this town set about 50 miles away. And me and the dog went into the town, knocked on the door, got inside, and they said, okay, where is it? And we forgot it. We left it back on the farm. And so I joined the carnival that night because it was in town, and that's my best thinking, you know. And they said, maybe your best thinking got you here. Think about it. I mean, go back over some of your decisions in your life. But there was a job opening. It just happened to be an opening that night. And I ran a shooting gallery and met a new him. And we hooked up and went through all this, you know, the southern states. And somewhere in Arkansas, I called my mother, told her where I was, what I was doing, and she wasn't happy about it. You know, I don't talk to my dad, and now my mother cries when I call home. And you know, I felt so bad about that. And I just, you know, I didn't talk to my mom and dad, only if I had to from that point on. And that was, you know, 4 years before I got to the program, 3.5 years before I got to the program. And my mother had to take care of all of that mess of those sheep and the horse and everything up there. And now my cry was only, I'm hurting myself. I'm not hurting anybody but myself. And I left a big mess in my wake, you know. Alcoholics Anonymous teaches you to look at yourself after you finally take that inventory and look at your defects and then look at who you've hurt and make those amends. And by going through that process, I was able to see in my life, you know, the people that you know, that's such a fallacy. It's such a lie. I'm only hurting myself. I hurt a lot of people with this is a very hurtful disease. But I you know, at that time, I buried those type of things. I thought, well, let mom take care of it, and she's no fun to talk to anymore either. But it hurt. And I ended up in Bogalusa, Louisiana, opening the door one day, and the shotguns were in my belly. They searched the room. They found my stash, and my stash was enough to get me for sales and possession. So I got thrown in maximum security down there, and so did my newfound him and the pet skunk and the dog, and we all went to jail. And somewhere in the course of that time, my father had gotten wind of this from my brother-in-law, who I called. My dad flew down and tried to hire me a lawyer and get me out, and they took me in handcuffs to this lawyer's office, and I didn't know my father was sitting there. And there I am sitting next to my dad, 1 foot away, and I can't look at him, and he can't look at me, and I'm a mess, and I'm sitting there in handcuffs. And it was one of those days I wish didn't have to exist in my life because I felt very, very small. And Of course, I went my way, and my dad went back to Iowa. And finally, they kicked me out, and I ended up in New Orleans. And for the next 3.5 years, I lived and died in the French Quarter of New Orleans, and found all the other quarter rats, and danced on Bourbon Street, and became a bartender, and lived the kind of life that just went into the darkness, you know. All of my, I couldn't sit at the bar anymore after living in the French Quarter for about a year and look at that back bar. And you know, Marilyn Monroe didn't happen anymore. You know, there was not even an inkling of that. It was, you know, what I saw in the back bar mirror, I didn't want to see. And I was just hoping maybe this 14th tequila would change. It would just shut the feeling off so I didn't have to care anymore. I didn't want to care at all anymore. And I was beginning to not care at all anymore, and whenever I did, I just wanted that drink to put that feeling down. I did not want to feel anymore, because what I felt and what I knew and what I saw, I didn't like anymore. And my parents came to visit, and they saw me living in filth with this man that from the carnival. That was my bond for 2 years of we'd been through jail together, so we just, I don't know, 2 years of black eyes and couldn't leave each other. We had a blood pack or something. It was hideous. But, there I am with my fresh black eye and the skunk and the snake running loose. And when they left and went back to Iowa that day, they left any resemblance of the daughter that they had raised. She was gone. And I was real tired, and I really wanted to go home with them, and I knew it wouldn't change. And I had given up having any sort of connection with my family. That was another day I wish wouldn't have had to have happened, but it was a day of getting me to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you think back on your life, there were those days, those days that you sold out that got you here. Didn't matter if they were little things or big things, but you sold out. And I ended up, blackouts were worse, violent situations were worse. I ended up walking over my friend who had been shot and killed on Mardi Gras Day because he had a gun, and he pointed it at the policeman, and the policeman blew him away, and I was 2 feet inside the door in a blackout. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, a speaker named Norm Alpe used to talk about seconds and inches. And if you think about it, there are a lot of seconds and inches in your life that you get to sit here tonight and have the gift of sobriety. And not everybody gets to sit here and have that gift. And it's something that's very precious and special to me. And I ended up in New York. From New York, I was on a book with some guys writing a book going to Southern California. And we ended up in a bar called Barney's Beanery. And you know, I just kept ending up in this silly bar. And I couldn't get a job. I had become unemployable, and I hated it out in Southern California. I got a ticket back to New Orleans. I got off the plane. I couldn't talk. I had to have enough drink to talk. I was a bloated mess of 170 pounds. I was a derelict woman. I had splotches on my cheeks. I didn't bathe or take care of myself anymore. And my old bar didn't want me back to work, which was on Lower Decatur Street. And I could smell it walking down the street, you know. I had become, that's what I had become with my alcoholism, and I didn't know. I just thought I was bad, and I didn't care anymore. I ended up back in Southern California on my way to Hawaii, and that was end of July of 1975. And ended up in that bar, Barney's Beanery, again, and there was a girl named Chris there that was nice to me. And I remember one night she went off to an A&A meeting. And she had a big book under her arm, and she was too drunk to drive her car, so they called her a taxi. And I remember taking my Jose Cuervo Gold and giving her a big cheer out the door. Good for her, you know. And I didn't know she was going to be my Eskimo to Alcoholics Anonymous, that someday I would call her, which would be someday very soon, because I got on the back of a Harley, and I went out to Palm Springs that night or the next night, and it was July 27th, and these guys left me off at the nightclub, and I didn't know why they'd even taken me along, if they were just going to drop me off somewhere. And I found out they needed some weight on the back tire because it was windy that night going through the desert. And that's what I had become, was the lower companion, the fat lower companion. And so there I was, and I met two new friends, and these friends took me when they got off work somewhere, and I didn't speak their language, and they didn't speak mine, and somewhere during the course of the evening, I guess I ticked them off, and they started to beat me up, and they broke my jaw in three places and broke my nose and raped me. And drug me around on the cement so badly that when I was found that they did not know I was a Caucasian. I had so many bruises all over me. And they did leave me outside of town in the morning, and it was off the side of a road. And when I was laying flat down on the sand, I had really, this is what I wanted. You don't understand. I had become the ultimate victim. This was just like, give it up now. Okay, let the last breath happen and it's over. I mean, that's all I cared about anymore, was I didn't care about living. I just cared about dying. And alcoholism does that to you. It takes away that zest for living life. In Alcoholics Anonymous, I've gotten that zest for living life back. I have gotten that, God, there's only so many hours in a day. Not, oh no, it's another day. I mean, that's the way I was living my life. And as I was laying flat on the sand face down, and, you know, I should have baked there off the side of the road in my concussion and in my blackout and bleeding from my face, I heard a voice, and the voice said, get up, I want to live. And I thought it was somebody calling me from the top of the road, but it wasn't. It was my God. It was some sort of little gift that I heard, this voice that told me to get up. And I did, and I found somebody's condominium and passed out in by their pool on a lawn chair. And, you know, that was another bit of 1 foot. You know, one more foot, you'd have another speaker. And the police came, and they caught the guys, and it was a whole big thing. And I was laying on the gurney going into surgery, and I was just elated that, you know, now I am a documented victim. You know, it says that word, you know. And, you know, if this had to happen, it's okay, because now they really know, you know. It's like, call home and tell them, you know. And I heard that voice again. I didn't want to hear that voice, but that voice told me that, you know, it's not their fault. It's not these guys. It's not their fault, and it's not the guy who broke your heart at 18, your sister, the Mensa, that Catholic God, your father, you know, the Capricorn. It's not their fault. They didn't do this to you. You did this to you. And I didn't want to hear that. I did not want to hear truth, because I don't know what to do with truth. You know, I drink at truth. I don't want to hear truth. Truth hurt too much when you're in the disease of alcoholism. And I laid in the hospital, and about 2 weeks, nobody sent me an airline ticket, and nobody bailed me out. And I was just about ready to get out of that hospital, and somebody said I could come stay with him, that, you know, he had a place I could stay. And it was in West Los Angeles, and they caught these guys, and I had to go back to court, and I had to go back to these doctors, and I was just really tired. I was just, any sort of new ideas were gone, you know, had been just kind of beaten out of me. And I was sitting on this above this liquor store where he lived, and he'd buy me red wine every day, and I'd stick a straw on the top of the red wine and stick a straw through the wires on the mouth where the tooth had been, and I would suck on the red wine every day. And I'm on a liquid diet, and what do? You know, but alcohol had lost its magic. It had absolutely lost any sort of transformation or warmth, and I didn't even care for the taste of it anymore, but I sat there and drank it anyway because I knew I had no choice. And he said I had to leave, and I called my mother, and my mother was in Iowa. My mother had known something had happened to me, and it took my mother 2 days to find me at this hospital and to find out I was going to be okay. And when I called my mother, she wasn't elated and said, let me save you, let me help you, let me take care of my little girl. My mother said, maybe you should go to the Salvation Army, Sharon. I can't help you anymore. I can't send you $20. And if she would have sent me $20, you would have another speaker tonight. That was a day of seconds and inches that my God was working in my life, because the next call I made was to that girl I had met in that bar. She was nice to me, and she had given me her phone number, and I was desperate, and I called her, and I didn't even relate Alcoholics Anonymous to her, or a whole new way of life. I didn't know anything about it, but I called Chris, and Chris said, I can't help you, but this woman can, and she gave me her number and made me promise to call Suzanne. I called Suzanne. Suzanne sent two newcomers over. I had no idea what was happening. I didn't even know I was calling a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that this woman would help me, and I needed to leave this place. I needed to stick around for court. I couldn't stick out my thumb anymore and try something new anywhere else, and I was tired, and I just did the next thing, and I was led to you. I was led to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. These two women got out of a car and picked me up. I sat on the steps of this liquor store, and they came at me, and they took me by the arms, and they put me in the back of this Volkswagen, and they took me to this meeting. It was about an hour away, and all they did was talk about themselves. I remember that. You know, they seemed to be very obsessed with talking about themselves. And nobody wanted to hear what I had to say, but you know what? I had these wires on my mouth for the first 3 months I was here anyway, so I couldn't really talk about anything. And I don't want to talk like this, you know? So people would just nod their head if I was had a conversation with them. They didn't understand a word I was saying. And it was a blessing in disguise because my ears had to open up, you know? And it was really, I had to learn to listen. So for that night, they took me to this meeting place, and there was a man with a tie and a suit on at the door, and I thought, uh-oh, here we go, you know. I didn't know where we were going, but uh-oh, here we go. And he said, welcome. And that was odd. And they ushered me in, and they gave me this seat in the front, and I don't know how they knew I was new, but I got an awful lot of attention, you know. And here I am in jeans that are coming apart, my shoes are broken, you can smell me at the door, and I hadn't combed or washed my hair in a month, and I've got this bleach-stained T-shirt and this bruised face and wires all over my mouth, but, you know, I couldn't figure it out at all how they knew I was new, and they seemed really proud. I think the sicker you are and the worse you look, the happier they are about, you know, this is my newcomer, you know, and some man that looked like my grandfather Wesley, who had, you know, died, and I was on too much LSD to go tell him goodbye, you know. So I was just always felt awful about that in my life. And this man looked like my grandfather Wesley, so I was nice to him, and I took the 20 questions and I sat there and answered them as he waited, and I passed with 17, and he was so happy, you know. And now I remember I said no to lower companions. I do remember I said no. I have my pride, you know, and the meeting went on, and I don't remember much of what happened. I remember the guy speaking at the end of his talk said he always waited for the spaceship to land and say, you can come home now, Bill. I thought, oh, he knows how I feel. There was just a flicker of identification. You know, there's just kind of that flicker when you get to Alcoholics Anonymous, and eventually that fire gets turned up by the actions that you take here. But there was just that flicker here, and Bill... these people were really kind to me, and they took me back and forth, and finally they moved me out of this liquor store, and they told me not to drink and use in between meetings or they wouldn't pick me up. And that was the criteria for getting a ride to these meetings. And I had absolutely nowhere else to go, and it was the only thing happening in my life. So I just kind of went along. And there I was, not drinking, using in between meetings, and about 30 days of sobriety when they stopped raising my hand for me, you know, I thought, my God, I have been sober for 30 days in a row. I did not even stay sober 10 minutes if I didn't want to. You know, I did not ever want to get sober, nor did I ever try to get sober. And my sobriety started without me even knowing what was going on. But I fell into a group of people that I'm still with the same home group today. I remember I was so confused. They asked me if I wanted to ride to tomorrow night's meeting, and I was so confused I said... you know, but it's a day at a time, you know, and I didn't accept this ride to tomorrow night's meeting, and an old-timer overheard me, and he took me in the corner, and he showed me his calendar of all his commitments month by month by month, and he asked me how I felt right now, you know, and if you ask a newcomer how they feel right now, you better be prepared to wait a couple minutes, you know, because you have to go through all of it in the Rolodex brain, you know, and finally you come up with that one answer, and the answer always is fine, fine, you know. So creative, and he said, well, that's what we're talking about right now. You know, emotionally right now is all you have to handle. If you can get through right now, and if you're safe and okay right now, aren't you? And he nodded my head, and he said, that's what we're talking about a day at a time, and you can go accept that ride to tomorrow night's meeting. Oh, I mean, that's the way I was when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and the people around here babied me and loved me and took the time to talk to me and didn't laugh at my questions. If you're new, ask a lot of questions. You have a right. I mean, that's the beautiful thing about being new is you don't have to know anything, nothing. And I was out there in the world acting like I knew everything, and I didn't learn a lot. And I have learned so much here because even now I go, what do you mean by that? What do you say? I don't understand that. I hope I always remain teachable here, because by remaining teachable, it keeps me willing. By remaining willing, it allows me to be teachable. You know, it's one of those paradoxes that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have continued to grow here. I have not graduated, nor do I want to graduate. I do not have all the answers, nor do I ever want to think I have all the answers. And it's a wonderful... bottomless. I mean, it's wonderful for people who want more. which I want more. And Alcoholics Anonymous continually allows me to get more. You know, there's constantly more inside that I'm finding out, and there's constantly more in life that I want to experience and have and do and feel and touch and all that stuff. It's just, you know, I feel so alive today, and even when I was this tiny little girl with all my life ahead of me, I don't think I felt this alive. I had that loud, loud head and that committee that lives up there. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have learned most of the time to starve the ones that, you know, are out to get me and send them to the back of the bus, you know, and not listen to them. And they're always going to be there, but I don't have to take those self-destructive actions, which will lead to allowing them to have some power over me, which will lead to eventually maybe picking up a drink. And it's that little girl telling her to go to bed. She goes to sleep. I have a little boy, too, but he had a pacifier a lot at meetings. I shoved that pacifier in, and at 2 years old, he threw it back at me. Not that he's independent or anything, but I got emotionally involved, and in 2 years of sobriety, I got married, and my dad came out to the wedding, and my mother and my sisters, and we had an Alcoholics Anonymous wedding, and it was in a Baptist church, and we had a day at a time putting the vows, till death do you part, and it was a day of ham sandwiches, a rock and roll band that had just gotten sober, and a lot of fun. And my father looked at all of you and said, Sharon, your life, look at your life today. You got it made. And instead of the earth trembling and the angels singing, it's because Daddy approved. What happened was I realized that, you know what, he's right, because I already had some of my own approval. I had worked a fourth and fifth step that was very, very hard for me to do. I almost got drunk at 11 months of sobriety. I started to run at 11 months of sobriety. I started to listen to about people that had their slips and what they had learned on their slips. Now, I didn't listen to the people that didn't come back from their slips, you know, but I was listening to that, and my thinking started again, and I wasn't calling my sponsor on a regular basis. I was going out to have my slip, and I ended up at the airport. And I called my sponsor to tell her goodbye. I thought it was a nice thing to do, and she was, you know, she was louder than my own head. She told me this story. I think they go to sponsor school, you know, and they see their, you know, baby at the airport going to have slip, and they open it up to these stories, you know. And she told me the Stella story, and, you know, and I'll share that story with you because it made a difference. She said, you know, my friend Stella wouldn't finish her inventory either, and she was 11 months sober, and she had long, beautiful black hair, and everybody liked her, but she wouldn't finish her inventory either, Sharon. She went out and had her slip, and she burned up in a bed. Well, that was the end of that, you know. It was, let's go have fun and burn up in a bed. I just couldn't do it, and she made me mad again, and so I went and picked up a pencil, and I went and picked up a notebook and sat in the coffee shop, and I wrote furiously. I was so mad at her. And what happened was I got past the fear. I got past the fear, and that inventory came out of me, and I took my fifth step with her before I was 1 year sober. And when I took my one-year cake, I felt like I was more committed to Alcoholics Anonymous. I felt like I was more of a member here. And of course, didn't have any defects of character for quite a while after that. And somewhere around 3 years of sobriety, I had to start copping on my own defects of character because, you know, I didn't connect. I remember hitting my husband on the head with a flashlight, and as I picked up the flashlight off his head, I thought, oh, this is anger, you know. I mean, I absolutely didn't connect anything in my life, and then I started to see. Chuck C. used to say, you don't see till you see, don't hear till you hear, and I started to see, and I started to hear, and I had to start working on me. And it was very painful to start working on me because, I would rather look at you and work on you and fix you, but I don't look at me. And I had to start doing that. And then I had to start making amends, and I got a new sponsor about that time. And my sponsor asked me how the relationship was with my father. And I said, well, you know, I wrote him that card and told him, gee, I'm sorry for all the things I caused in your life, and I'm sober now, and, you know, I wrote in that card. And she said, well, how's your relationship with your father now? I said, well, it's still kind of, we don't talk one-on-one. We talk maybe mom and dad and me on the line, you know, but gee, dad and I don't talk, you know. And she said, well, how's your relationship? And I said, not so good. And she said, well, how much money do you owe him? And I thought, what is she talking about? How much money do I owe? You know, she doesn't know anything about my past. And so she said, well, you know, why don't you call him and ask him? And I thought, well, that's pretty bold of her. And but I did what she said because I thought he'd say, forget it. You know, it's been too many years. And But I called my father, and my dad's a Capricorn, and I swear he had a calculator tape stuck in that big book, because he had gone to a meeting out here and picked up that big book when he was at my wedding, and he had read it, and he was waiting for Sharon to call, you know. And so when I called, I mean, they gave me that bottom line figure, and I almost gasped, and I was a little resentful that he didn't even have to hesitate to give me this figure. And so I called up my sponsor, and I said, he told me it's this much. And she said, you're probably getting off light. And I said, well, you're no good. I had nobody to commiserate with. And she said, well, you know, what can you afford every month? And we talked about it for a while. And so she said, well, in a couple of days, call him back and ask him if those terms are okay with him. And I thought, well, good, 2 days. Let him think about it. I paid for most of my wedding. He paid for all the other children's. I never went to Europe like the rest of them. I never got a car. Yeah, I took a few, but I never got one. And, you know, he'll think of some. I never finished my college education like the rest of them. You know, I practically got kicked out. And but I thought, well, he'll think about it and be a little lighter on me. Well, I called him in 2 days and told him the terms, and he said, fine. You know, so here I am, resentful. I'm calling my sponsor again, saying, he said, fine. She said, okay, then you make out those envelopes and without fail, because you're working a step of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're an example. You're an example of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You are not late with that check. And I thought, geez, okay. And so then she added, you know, they wait for you to really get vulnerable, and then they push you up against the wall even further, you know. And she said, you know, put a note about your life and a newsy note about what you're doing, and just add it to that. With every check, put a note about your life. And I told her he doesn't care. And she said, I don't care. Do it anyway. You know, she didn't want to hear it. Well, we started doing this. And the notes were very stilted. I remember how stilted they were in the beginning. And it was very hard for me to write those notes. And as time went on, they got a little easier to write those notes. And then as time went on, I began to get resentful about, he doesn't need this money, and I don't have it this month. And I call her up and whine, you know. And don't do that. Don't call up and whine at your sponsor about a step you're working, you know, because they don't want to hear it. She told me, you know, she had a good story, you know, this baby whining about working a step. You know, she looked at that sponsor book again, and she told me that, you know, he's probably putting it into a trust fund so I can buy that Jaguar I've been wanting to buy. And so I sent it early for a couple of months, you know. Great sponsor. And so here we are, sending these checks early, and the notes are getting nicer, you know. I'm thinking maybe he's putting it into a trust fund for me. And we did this for a number of years. And he called me. It was between Christmas and New Year's, and it was my father was on the phone. I thought, who died, you know, and my dad never called me. And my father told me that the debt was free and clear, Merry Christmas, that I did not have to send him any more checks. But don't stop sending me the notes. And it was like the little Christmas elves cut those chips right off my shoulders. And I was able to walk into a relationship guilt-free, eyeball-to-eyeball with my dad because of working the step with Alcoholics Anonymous. And because I had a sponsor that demanded more of me than I thought I could provide. I had a sponsor that loved me more than I love myself. I have a God that loves me more than I love myself and believed in me more than I believed in myself. And my dad and I began to walk into a new relationship that has continually gotten better. They just had their 50-year anniversary, and I was able to go home. And as they called up the children, and about 250, 300 townspeople showed up at this little country club in this small town. And they called the children up, you know, in order, and I was in order. You know, they didn't leave me till the end, or they didn't forget about me, or I wasn't drunk in the bar, or had missed my plane, or gotten off at the wrong city off the airplane. I used to do that a lot. You know, there I was, and they were proud of me, and I was able to be with Casey, and I was able to be with my son, Wesley, and who I got to name after my grandfather and never got to make amends to. And there I was. They were proud of me, and I was really a part of that family. And the beauty of working this step with my father was that about 2 months ago, a little girl in our meeting, you know why this makes me cry, but it does, came up to me and said, because of you, I'm sending my father checks every month. And because of you, I'm writing a note to him. And would you read my first note, please, to my dad? And so we've been doing that every month. I've been reading her notes, and they're getting more flowing, and they're getting more, you know, easier. I'm watching her open up a little bit, and it just makes me feel so joyous that our experience can be passed along in Alcoholics Anonymous. It just makes me feel worth so much. And I didn't know that that was going to happen by starting to work with others. I had no idea. I thought it was a waste of time and a pain in the neck, you know. And the joy that I have gotten by watching somebody walk into their first meeting and being so drunk you have to tie their shoes for them so they don't trip and fall and hurt themselves, to giving a toast at her wedding with Perrier, of course, and having me do the toast is very, very joyous, a wonderful thing. As an alcoholic, he gives me all these napkins.
It's too late in the talk for this much of a tearjerker. We're like, okay. But I had my son. I had a son in 1984, and as I told you, I got to name him after my grandfather, and he has all his fingers and all his toes, and he changed my life entirely. And I had worked with enough newcomers that I was ready to be a mother now, I think. And I had a very joyous marriage, and for about a year and a half, and then my husband left, and he's sober on the program, and he's still sober on the program, and thank God nobody had to drink. But it was one of the most painful years of my life, and I became the victim again, and I started to judge all of you again, and I walked around the meetings that nobody got custody of the meetings, so they were there, you know, and he was there, and his new girlfriend was there, and it wasn't much fun, and my sponsor of 21 years that year prior had smoked some pot, so she had 21 days, and I had to get a new sponsor. And I asked a man named Clancy to be my sponsor, and he's been in our group, founded our group, and I had watched him all those years. And, you know, he's 33 years sober, and he's still excited about working with newcomers. He's still excited about coming to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope to God, a day at a time, if I get that old in this program, that I still have that spark of life with Alcoholics Anonymous, because that is a gift. You know, you get to watch, you get to work with those new people and watch them come in with nobody home, and about 3 months later, there's somebody home. Somebody turned on the switch, you know, and that gives me such hope to watch that happen, because it's just, it's something I can't do. It's something that happens here in the fellowship and in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's something that's magical and mystical, and I love to be able to watch it happen. And I hope I'm always involved. And he became my sponsor, and that year was very tough, and I was very much like a newcomer. And I had to go to work again, and it was very hard for me to even show up at meetings, but I did it, and I did it with you know, an angry face and an angry attitude, but I showed up, and I didn't sit home, because the people in Alcoholics Anonymous really wouldn't let me. They came and they picked me up, and they took me to job interviews, and they took me to meetings, but I was angry and resentful and hurt, and I was the victim. You know, you a loyal Leo, and you give her betrayal on top of that, and I just carried that right to the max. And I ended up one night going to baptize him and his new girlfriend with black coffee, and I was on my way over to do that with a couple of cups in my hand, and my sponsor caught me halfway. He was in town, and he said to me, as he took the coffee out of my hands, you know, and looked me in the eyes and squared me off with, you know, with his hands on my shoulders, and he said, "Sharon, you'll walk through this with dignity and grace so you can be an example for others." And he said it very quietly and very firmly, and there was something in his voice that I believed him. And I was able to turn and walk back into my own life and work my own steps and look at my own defects and look at where I went wrong and look at what I did wrong and not point the finger. And I was able to walk into some freedom because of that. It took a while, but I was able to finally have the healing. And the healing finally happened. The wholeness finally came, and I was able to walk into a brand new dimension. I was really rocketed into the fourth dimension. It really happened for me then. And the view that I have had since then has just been more spectacular and more spectacular and more spectacular. It's been like standing at somewhere and just in awe of the beauty of life. I'm very, very respectful of this program, even more now. And that was 6 years ago. And a lot has changed for me since then. I got a job. And then I got a better job, and I walked into what I do today as just a clerical person, and today I have a profession where I work. They're giving me another promotion at Christmas time. I work with people that you know, they're Harvard graduates and they think I'm smart, and I don't know. You know, all I do is suit up and show up, and when they ask me how I am, I say, I'm fine, thank you, how are you? You know, I don't really tell them how I feel or what I think, and my life is good today. I was home a couple of years ago, and my son and I were sitting at the table, and my dad was reading the paper, and he was playing, my son was playing with his Legos, my mom was cooking, and I was sitting there in Iowa listening to the locusts, and you know, feeling the evening start and watch the lightning bugs come out, and something came over me, and it was a feeling of you belong to this family. And I had never had that feeling before, and it was quite the healing. This is a very loving, healing program, and all you have to do is work the steps and work them hard, but work them, you know, and have a God in my life. I have a God in my life that has progressed from a Beacon's moving van to the God I have today, because my first God was Beacon's moving van, and it doesn't matter. It still works. You know, whenever my son and I are driving somewhere, he'll point it out to me. Look, Mom, there's Beacon's. There's God, you know, and I always feel better when I see a Beacon's box or a Beacon's truck or anything. I always know that I'm not alone, because we don't do this alone, and my life today is full of people that are supportive and loving and kind, and I'm not sitting looking in that back bar mirror afraid to see what I'm going to see. I am somebody who can walk through my life with a lot of dignity and a lot of grace. I am somebody who has a lot of experience to offer the new person or to offer somebody else going through a tough time. You know, if you're going through a tough time, you're not thrown out in the woods. It's just like being in the hallway. You know, you're there in the hallway with other people. If you take the blinders off and look around you, there's other people having a hard time too. Talk to them and find out why they're in the hallway. You know, and you can all sit in the hallway together and throw down some throw pillows, hang some art, crack open a window, and wait for the next door to open, you know, and be glad when you get through the next door, and be glad, you know, be glad, because it's hopeful. I have had a lot of hallways in my life, and there's been a lot of doors closing and a lot of doors opening, and I hope that there will be more. Because that's the growth periods for me, and I don't wake up in the morning and say, geez, let me hurt, let me grow. You know, I just don't do that, you know. Life goes on and things happen in life that go on, but if you walk through the hallway and you share with others and you know that you're not alone and you don't isolate, the door will open for you, because it always does. Don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle happens. Just don't do it. Find yourself a sponsor. You know, it's been really a lot, it's been a good year for me. I've had a lot of fun in my relationship with Casey, and I think we've gotten to another point where we're able to know each other on a spiritual level, and that's nice. We do the steps together, and we're reading the book together, and that's something that I never thought I would be able to share with another human being, especially a man in my life, because it's a part for me that I'm learning how to trust and be vulnerable again, and the relationship with my son has just gotten better. His father is very involved in our life, and because of my son, and they have a good relationship, and his my ex-stepwife, I have a good relationship with her too, and she's got a son, and so I just called my son before I got up here tonight, and he's with his half-brother tonight, and he was telling me that he's going to call me in the morning, and he said, Daryl wakes me up at 4:30, Mom. And I thought, no, Wesley, don't call me at 4:30 in the morning. Wait till about 9. And he said, okay, I will, Mom. I'll wait till about 9. But, you know, my son is proud of his mom today. He's in a Catholic school, you know, and he's getting a lot of love and a lot of discipline, and I think it's very important for him. And he wants to go to school in the morning. He's happy to go to school in the morning. And they were reading A.A. Milne the other day in class, and he stuck up his hand and he said he knows A.A. His mommy's in A.A., and he told the teacher and all the kids in class that, you know, all about his mommy and A.A., and that's okay, because the word got back to the principal of the school, who's one of us, you know, and then she called me, and so I was prepared for all those kids to look at me funny, but they didn't, you know, it's no big deal to them, but he's proud of his mom today, and my life is good today, and I want to thank you for the dignity and the grace that I have, and when we say the Lord's Prayer and you hold each other's hand, feel the power, and love each other. You don't have to like each other, but love each other. Thank you very much.